Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
The Bob Seska Show.
Bob Seska.
Hi, this is Leslie Nielsen. Merry Christmas, you eggnog-sucking patsies.
The Bob Seska Show.
From our nation's capital, it is Wednesday, December 8, 2021, and this is the interview edition of the Bob Seska Show on the Sexy Liberal Podcast Network. Hi, how you doing? My name is Bob.
Hello, Bob.
Hello. Day 323 of the Biden-Harris administration, 335 days until the 22 midterms. I am on Instagram. Follow me over there. The Bob Seska is my handle, and I'm on Twitter at BobSeska_go. All right, Heather Timmons is the White House editor for Reuters. Big deal right here. And a couple of weeks ago, she called me out on Twitter. I'll talk about why when we bring Heather in. But I was glad she spoke up because this is one of the most challenging problems we face. And so it's worthy of discussion. The role of the free press in a time when democracy is on the brink of ending. How can the press inform the nation of this crisis brought about by Donald Trump and the Republican Party while also maintaining its integrity and objectivity? For me, it's a super delicate conversation because I strongly believe we need to keep the news media honest, but I also understand that it's under immense, immense, immense pressure, both financially and journalistically. So we'll get into all of this with Heather Timmons. Links in the description to support her work, as well as some of the excellent reporting at Reuters. And if I sound reticent during all of this, it's only because I want the press to succeed and endure, while at the same time, many publications are just pissing me off. All right, meantime, please help support this independent podcast by subscribing to our bonus content at BobSeskaShow.com. All right, here comes my chat with Heather Timmons from Reuters.
So tell me, thank you for indulging me after I was an asshole on Twitter.
No way. No, seriously. A few weeks ago, I tweeted a gripe about the press and I was generalizing a little too much. And you rightfully called me out on it. And too often people conflate cable news with the entire press corps. Not every sure. publication or network has the same approach to covering politics. And I kind of fell into that trap where I'm seeing, you know, Chuck Todd on Meet the Press or something like that. And he's doing kind of this both sides equivalence sort of thing. And that irritated me. And I think the part of the context had to do with the jobs numbers. We'll come back to that. But you deserve to pull the reins back on me in that case, because one of the things that I've been talking about on this show quite a bit is that mistake where people see what's happening on cable news and automatically assume that this is happening, in editorial boards and newsrooms across the country, whether it's print or radio or whatever. And that's not necessarily the case, is it?
No, definitely not. We are trying really hard at Reuters to do this very straightforward, because that's what Reuters is, mm-hmm. Like really fact-based. Here is what's going on. Here's yeah. the numbers. Yep. Here's the thing. We don't do opinion. We don't have opinion columns. We don't have opinion writers. We just don't do it. Because there is right now this growing frustration with the quality of political coverage that's coming mm-hmm. from cable news and a lot of other places too, really. I just think, you know, it now even more than ever before, like all the media is getting lumped into mainstream media, you suck. And yeah, it's coming, you know, it's coming at a time right now where this industry is being decimated. Mm-hmm. You know, it's being devastated. We're losing local newspapers. We're losing thousands, tens of thousands of journalists, you know, over the past, I think it's 6 years. I've got the numbers here somewhere. But so it's just like, this is this criticism that I'm hearing from you and lots of other people is, you know, it's just, it's overlooking, I think, what is the real fundamental problem that's happening right now is that our fact-based news industry in America is shaky. You know, it is suffering, and it needs help, and it needs money, and it needs people to believe in it again. So,
and is this a consequence of the internet? Is this a consequence of some other factor? Obviously, cable television factors into all of this. But I think one of the things that you brought up that I was completely unaware of is this hedge fund, Alden Global Capital, I think it is. What's going on with that? How is that hedge fund decimating newsrooms?
Well, there, you know, because there's a lot of, because there still are some regional newspapers. Mm-hmm. They just bought up the Baltimore Sun and the Chicago Tribune, by the way.
Wow.
That still have an old school, you know, they have a number of loyal subscribers. Mm-hmm. And when I say newspaper, I mean, like anything that used to be a newspaper, but does news on the internet that you have to pay for, you know, I'm not talking necessarily about a paper. But what this hedge fund found is that they could go in there and it's a predictable stream of revenue that they could sop up while shrinking the newsroom and shrinking it and shrinking it and shrinking it until the product is, you know, inconsequential as the news gets worse.
Yeah.
And eventually subscribers start to fall away, but it doesn't matter.
Right.
They can take profits out of that. And mm-hmm. and that, you know, and there's a great that I think I posted it, but there's a great Atlantic story on just sort of how blasé they are about that. You know, I think the author, like many journalists, made the mistake of thinking everybody thinks journalism matters and is sacred. And they were just like, well, no, what? There's like money to be had. Why would we not take the money?
So they're basically downsizing newsrooms. Is that part of it to save some money? I mean, how do they expect any sort of content to appear on these publications, whether it's print, internet, or both? I don't understand the business model here other than the, you know, the bust out.
It is.
Bust out.
Thing, yeah, it's bust out. It is. It's just take your short-term gains. There's no long-term business model. There's not. It's just not. And what's happening? And soon after you and I were tweeting at each other, the Margaret Sullivan, who does a great column for the Washington Post about, you know, the media industry, put out something great on the same thing. You know, we have all of these news deserts around America, and this might not be sort of news to you, but it mattered so much, particularly during the pandemic. There's something like 3/4 of American counties right now don't have a daily newspaper. Mm-hmm. They might have a weekly one. And many of them, you know, something like a fifth of them just don't have any local news at all. Yeah. And so when you're trying to get information about, you know, a thing that's maybe your neighbors are talking about, you know, not trusting the vaccine, or you're not sure about what COVID, whatever, and you don't have any local source of news, mm-hmm. where you know, you might know the person writing the story, you might know the doctor they're quoting, you're going to turn to the internet for news, you're going to get, everything has become very nationalized.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so there's no, so those are, you know, in those particular areas, people tend to vote less mm-hmm. with news deserts. When they do vote, they vote strictly on party lines. You know, it's sort of, there's a dearth of information about how to make considered decisions happening.
Yeah, yeah. But I feel like to an extent, there is obviously factors like Alden Global Capital, but there's this other side of it that tends to be a point of frustration for me a lot of times, which is, you mm-hmm. know, when I go to write a piece for whatever publication, I have to say, you know, sometimes I have to reject ideas for something based on the fact that no one will read it. I mean, here's a great example, Heather. Anytime I write about...
You're speaking to the converted. Go ahead.
Well, yeah. But I mean, anytime I write about the climate crisis, oh mm-hmm. my God, mm-hmm. it's like crickets chirping. The reach drops to almost nothing. People just don't want to hear it. They don't want to read about it. So they move on. And I get the sense that this happens quite a bit, where there's a topic that's an extremely important topic that news consumers simply don't consume. And that shapes and sculpts the direction of the news, whether we like it or not. That's how it goes. Is that something that you've noticed in your experience? Sounds like it has.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, of course. And before I worked for Reuters, I worked for a startup that was called Quartz, that was part of the Atlantic, but we were a pure startup. So, you know, we lived and died by traffic, honestly. And a lot of it was, you know, we would try to figure out how to write things in ways that people wanted to read that would also get out quality information.
Yeah.
You know, I was based in Hong Kong for a while with them. And I remember we wrote something at one point about the new president who had been elected, who was a single woman with two cats. And we had put that in the headline and then put the whole history of like Taiwan and its battle with China. But then we could see, you know, because you can get those great data metrics and you can see what people are reading. And we're like, oh, they came for the cat headline, but they stayed for the history of Taiwan.
Oh, hey, excellent. Great. Yeah.
But I mean that, you know, how to write about climate in a way to engage more consumers is something I think a lot of news organizations have struggled with. We have a big climate section at Reuters right now. You know, the thing that's happening is businesses are realizing that climate mitigation is big business, that, you know, green finance is going to be big business. So our corporate clients, you know, it's important information for them.
Absolutely. Well, let me ask you this before we go any further. Are you at the White House right now? Where do you work? Are you there or someplace else? Are you at the Reuters offices? Where are you based?
So we have, our offices are, are right in downtown. We have seven reporters that go into the White House. Because of COVID, we have a little room in there, and all of the news organizations that have regular people in there have a little space. Nice. It's like a little tiny submarine. Mm-hmm. Frankly, we just don't like to stack people in there right now. For a really long time, we were sending one person only, and now we'll kind of do two if there's a lot going on there right now. So I go back and forth between our office and my house.
Nice.
I'm home right now. Actually.
Yeah. Oh, great. So, and you were promoted to White House editor back in February, but you were also a White House correspondent at some point. When was that?
I did that for Quartz. It was an experimental, you know, they were such a new startup and we thought, well, let's just put somebody in the White House. And so I moved back to the United States after being away for 14 years at the end of 2016, after the 2016 election. And
wow.
It was a bit of a culture shock because I had left the country. I mean, I left the country before Facebook, you know, and so I came back to America and I was like, whoa, what is going on here?
Oh, my God.
You
were the Asia bureau chief, weren't you?
Yes.
That was the job.
I was for Quartz. And then I worked for the New York Times for 10 years before that in India and in London. So, so I spent a big stretch of time outside of the U.S. and it made coming back here and seeing what's going on with the media landscape and the political landscape, you know, all the more bleak to me or glaring.
Yeah. Yeah. What was that adjustment like once you arrive back? You're in the White House, Donald Trump takes over and it's an all out war against the enemy of the people. I mean, that had to have been extremely difficult.
I think there's something really, there's something sort of not easy, but if you're a foreign correspondent, if you're living in another country, it is easier to look at somebody else's government, somebody else's system and be like, whoa, you people should fix this. This is really messed up. Let's write this story about how this is messed up. And then you come home and you go, wow, this is ours. This whole, you know, massive divide, the misinformation that's happening.
Yeah.
All of that. So I think more than anything else, that was kind of, you know, my big mental shock.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. Have you read the Dana Milbank piece yet in the Post? He wrote about, he actually availed himself of this outfit called Fiscal Note, and they were able to use this system to compare the coverage of the final year of Donald Trump versus
the first year
of Joe Biden. Mm-hmm. And he writes, after a honeymoon of slightly positive coverage in the first 3 months of this year, Biden's press for the past 4 months has been as bad as, and for a time worse than, the coverage Trump received for the same 4 months of 2020. What's your reaction to that?
I'm going to push back a little bit on the methodology of, you know, it's great that he seems to have attached some sort of methodology to studying this. And it is something that I think we all have been feeling, you know, in some ways. It's like, well, coverage does feel like for an economy that's going pretty much gangbusters. And yeah, there's a little inflation, but the job, you know, unemployment is really low and everybody's got lots of savings. People have money. Like what's, I don't think the methodology actually that he applied there is fantastic. So I don't, you know, I'm not 100% sold on that as I'm going to go back to the local journalism thing again, and I will tell you why.
Okay.
Because Washington Press coverage is its own, Washington is its own little media fishbowl.
Yeah.
To cover the White House and the next presidential candidate for so many decades was sort of the, you know, one of the pinnacles of the jobs you could possibly ever get by working your way up from some small town paper and some little, you know, you would have job after job after job that you would do to finally claw your way up to the very top. And be very careful here to not insult, you know, our competitors, but I think there's a lot of Washington-based media focused on what's going on in Congress, you know, what's going on in the White House stuff that is sort of smaller, almost like trade type publications, which is where some of the bigger institutions are now getting their Washington reporters from instead of those small towns. This is a town where when one party's in power, the other party is sitting on the sidelines, whispering into everybody's ears about what they're going to do as soon as they kick those guys out. And it feels to me almost like this fishbowl is just listening to itself a little bit too much. You know, there's you see what's going on with the Republican Party right now, and there are such deep divisions that the one thing that they can agree on is they want to get rid of Joe Biden. Mm-hmm. And the messaging machine around that and the number of think tanks that are spread out around Washington, D.C. that generate, quote unquote, you know, economic analysis, but it is biased. There's quite a few of them.
Yeah.
You know, and so there's a whole industry out here that is sort of politically slanted economic research. Mm-hmm. And I think that's contributing to it too. I'm sorry, it's a long and maybe boring answer.
No, just fine.
But there's just a whole lot of, you know what I mean? Like there's a huge sort of industry and think tanks and other things out there dedicated to getting out the message that this guy is doing badly. I was just looking at this statistic that only journalists care about, but right now the number of public relations people in America to journalists, the ratio right now is 6-1, and that was 3-1 a decade ago because we've lost so many journalism jobs.
Wow.
And there's so much more money in sort of like, you know, funneling through these think tanks and other things that again will present stuff as research or present things as, you know, analysis, but that very often are at least paid for by somebody with a political agenda.
But in terms of those think tanks, I was not necessarily aware that they did have some influence on certain reporters, I guess. There's active lobbying going on, isn't there?
Well, I mean, not necessarily influence, but they're going to be quoted. Yeah. You know, if AEI and the Heritage Foundation are putting out a statement saying, you know, the latest jobs numbers show that Biden has created a hollow victory for blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's going to wind up in a story.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's they will be identified probably as a conservative leaning, you know, think tank, but that is sort of just how the sausage is made. And I know that's probably an unsatisfying answer to you too, but
I guess my question is, why is the sausage made that way? Because I think that it seems like that might be the source of a lot of dissatisfaction where, unequivocally good news for President X, why is it being countermanded by this quote from someone with an obvious agenda? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I hear you. I mean, you know, what's unequivocal good news? We kind of go to this, like, what is objectively good news thing? Yeah, you know, wage growth is great, but mm-hmm. if you're the Chamber of Commerce and your members are paying more money, they're unhappy. So,
yeah.
I mean, you come to this thing where it's like everything, you know, everything can't be good news for everybody.
How do you cover an entire political party, basically one half of the political debate, that is dedicated to upending democracy, that is basically managing and contributing to the decline of American democracy? I mean, in the best case scenario, how do you approach something like that?
Mm-hmm. It's a conversation that's happening at every Washington newsroom right now. And I think one part of it that you hit on, you know, that there is a sort of a strategy of flooding the zone and using some of the maybe weaknesses or whatever you want to call it in American journalism system to your benefit. Mm-hmm. And part of the real difficulty for, I think, American media with that is that, you know, you never want to be part of the story.
Yeah.
And realizing that that's happening and realizing that is it just suddenly makes media part of the story. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't have a great answer for you right now, except for that it's something that, you know, we have been thinking a lot about. And, you know, we and everybody else has got sort of a Reuters fact check thing, you know, there's constant misinformation coming out and we're fact checking our little hearts out. I have moments where I'm like, I don't know if that is anywhere near enough to overcome the flood of other not fact-based news that's happening. Mm-hmm. And I shouldn't even call it information, non-fact-based information that's happening out there.
Okie dokie, we'll get back to our conversation with Heather Timmons here in just one second. But first, today's show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Is there something interfering with your happiness or maybe preventing you from achieving your goals? Well, BetterHelp is going to assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist in under 48 hours. This isn't a crisis line. This isn't self-help. It's professional therapy done securely on the internet. You can log into your account anytime you want and send a message to your therapist. You're going to get timely and thoughtful responses. Plus, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions so you won't ever have to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room as with traditional therapist offices. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy and free to change therapists if needed. It's more affordable than traditional offline therapy, and financial aid is available if you can't afford it. BetterHelp wants you to start living a happier life today. Visit their website and read their testimonials posted daily. BetterHelp.com/Seska. That's BetterHelp.com/CESCA. And join the over 2 million people who've taken charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional. In fact, so many people are using BetterHelp that they're recruiting additional therapists in all 50 states. Special offer right now for Bob Seska Show listeners. Get 10% off your first month at BetterHelp.com/Seska. Link in the description at BobSeska.com. BetterHelp.com/Seska. Thank you.
The Bob Seska Show.
I think part of the problem is that, say, for example, something like, I don't know, Helsinki or the attempt to cheat in the election via Ukraine. It seems extraordinarily challenging to be able to amplify those kinds of stories when there's only a certain level of tone that you can really use. And it doesn't seem like it's adequate to be able to fully embody the crisis that it's actually attempting to cover. Do you see what I mean? Where
I do. I hear what you're saying. I mean, you know, we and I think many other are very, very, very careful to always say, you know, fraudulent claims that he didn't lose the last election and mm-hmm. Biden won by 7 million votes. I would, you know, point you to something else, which is something our investigative team has been doing a lot of, is just digging into what we think is the next step for these false election claims, which is, you know, violence, which mm-hmm. is, and they have done a couple really great pieces that I'll send to you, but just about some of the election officials who certified results being targeted by outlets like the Gateway Pundit, targeted by name, and then receiving death threats and having to leave their houses and you know, and having their lives completely upended. Mm-hmm. And that's happening, you know, not just with the Georgia Secretary of State, who you probably know about, but these lower level election officials, many of whom are women of color, who have been targeted specifically. Mm-hmm. And I think this is the next thing that's happening. So it's sort of like, you know, we're kind of going beyond this idea that they're maybe not, you know, that there's an undemocratic element, but actually what is the next step is using violence.
Well, you know, on one hand, I understand the challenge and the mandate for the press to just cover the facts. But I think a lot of people, and I don't know where I land on this necessarily, you know, mm-hmm. coming from journalism, I tend to land more on, you know, somewhere in between. I don't know. It's a very challenging thing to kind of analyze, because on one hand, I respect and I understand the way journalism is supposed to be. But on the other hand, I feel like, why aren't some of these publications raising more alarm bells about what's happening? I think what people are expecting is, you know, spinning sirens and hey, oh my God, you guys right. need to be really, really concerned about this particular story. But at the same time, the press is remaining rather clinical about it. I think a lot of readers are going, I don't know if that's adequate. Do you see what I mean?
I do. I mean, like I said, Reuters is not, you know, we are always going to be straight on the facts. Yeah. And this, you know, level of investigation that we've been doing about where the facts lead when you go down this path of trying to, you know, manipulate election results, mm-hmm. And you know, should paint a picture in people's mind of what could happen next. I mean, I guess I would partially say that's not probably not the media's role in my no. mind to put that, you know, spinning siren Drudge Report thing on the, you know, I mean, it's certainly the role of a, you know, of a media analyst type or a mm-hmm. democracy activist type or something, but it's just not what we do.
I completely understand that. Everything we're talking about is such a delicate conversation to have, because there are certain responsibilities that you and your colleagues have in all of this. And you have to kind of maintain some sort of grasp of those values. You know what I mean?
Well, I would, you know, I would just go back to the beginning of our conversation. There's this feeling that the fact-based news media is some sort of organized monolith that behind the scenes is all coordinating on something.
Yeah.
We hate each other. We have no money. We're all exhausted. You know what I mean? Like, I want to punch Chuck Todd in the face. No, I don't. I'm just kidding. But, you know, like it's not, there's no cohesion. We compete over stories. We compete over people, mm-hmm. You know, organized news, you know, we should have been organizing to fight back on Facebook and Google for stealing our advertising revenue for years, but we can't organize to do that.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just not an industry that like lends itself to any kind of cohesion. And that's making me crazy too. No, mm-hmm. I hear you. I do hear you. I totally hear you. And I just, it's just never been that way. I've seen it sort of confront other problems and be unable to present a unified front on it. So. Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things that we were talking about initially when we kind of bumped into each other on Twitter a couple of weeks ago was some of the coverage of the jobs numbers. And I remember at the time I was kind of irritated by some of the big papers of record missing the upward revisions in the jobs numbers, having spent a lot of the summer doom reporting about the Biden economy all summer long. And then suddenly in the Washington Post, you know, a week or 10 days after the election, oh, look at this. We found these revisions, these upward revisions of all the jobs numbers, showing that there were way more jobs created over the summer than was initially reported. And I found that irritating, but you noted that Reuters had reported on those things back in the summertime. How do you get that to resonate more? when it's obvious that, there was some reporting on those things, but the reporting that was like, oh, look at the Biden economy stagnating and here comes inflation and supply chains and not enough jobs being created. What happened? How do you get the actual news to break through the crap?
You know, it's I think it's an age old problem with the news industry.
Yeah.
I you know, years ago, I had an editor named Seymour Zucker, and I would bring him a story about something going well. And he'd be like, I get along with my wife. So what?
You
know, it's like, it is an industry that wants to find problems. Mm-hmm. And that's no excuse. It's not. And I think, you know, you probably, if you went back and looked, you'd be surprised and you would probably find that everyone did cover that there was an upward revision somewhere, but you just didn't notice and it didn't resonate. You're right. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it was buried, or maybe it was, it just wasn't something that was on the front page, obviously. Yeah. Except for to say this is an industry, you know, this is an age old industry problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, problems and drama get clicks. I mean, let's face it. Great news about the Biden administration is not going to get the same clicks as, oh, my God, the sky is falling. I mean, that's just the disparity that we're living with right now. And I guess the worry is that in the context of the Biden administration, I think a lot of people are going, well, this administration has got to succeed because the alternative is disaster. And I think a lot of people, when they see negative news about the Biden administration, especially in the context of most of that negative news being normal politics, I think people get really sketchy about that kind of stuff. And that tends to be the source of a lot of angst online when it comes mm-hmm. to the press. It'd be like, well, you know, this is normal shit. Why is the normal shit getting all kinds of terrible press when the abnormal shit got about the same amount of press? I mean, this is, I think, the centerpiece of the problem that we're facing right now. Don't you think?
I do hear on that. And I'm thinking, you know, I mean, the loudest voices right now are the ones that are getting heard first. So if you look at something like the Virginia election and you sort of dig into like what happened with that CRT thing, mm-hmm. it was like a couple hundred parents in a district of thousands and thousands that first started, you know, these protests and things, and the media paid attention to the loud voice there, which was people, you know, raising a big stink about what was happening. They didn't, it's hard to write a story about the rest of the people who are like, oh God, I don't care about that, or that's not important to me, or I think you're stupid, but I'm sitting home and I'm talking to my friends about it, but I'm not out protesting about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like it's just inevitable that the loudest voice is going to take up a lot of the oxygen, first of all.
Yeah. I mean, how do you say this just has never happened before and it's immensely dangerous, but you can't necessarily put that into a news story, can you? I mean, that's too much color, don't you think? Or,
well, I mean, no, of course you can say there is no historical precedent for this to happen, or these people that you can quote say that they, historians, I love talking to historians about U.S. history. Mm-hmm. You know, they say that they see echoes of something that happened 110 years ago, and this is maybe what we could expect next. Do those for sure, of course. You mm-hmm. can do those kind of stories. I think the kind of alarm bells that you want someone to sound, you know, the sort of fact-based media is maybe not the first place that should be sounding that. You know, we quote people that say this is potentially very dangerous, and here's why I think that.
Is there anything that you're seeing that you wish was happening differently in the press by and large? I mean, Reuters, we'll put Reuters aside. Is there anything you're seeing that you go, okay, guys, you're doing it wrong?
I don't know. That's a really good question. I go back and forth on that a lot. I mean, you know, one thing that, you know, is very obvious, and again, going back to our economics talk, and I used to cover economics, is just the lack of thoughtful comprehensive coverage about what's been happening with this economy, for sure, would be great. And that shouldn't be that hard even to fix, really. You know, is just, if you're going to interview a family that's spending more on milk, you also got to mention the fact that they're getting stimulus checks and they're this and they're that, so that you have a comprehensive picture of what's going on with their finances. You know, that kind of stuff. What's our long-term trajectory, though? I don't know. I tend to be a little doomsay-ish on this sometimes.
No, that's fine, because I am way more doomsay-ish than you are. You can't possibly shock me with anything, that's for sure. But I do not envy the position you're in, Heather, or any of your colleagues for that matter, because it is, no matter how you guys slice it, one way or another, you're going to piss someone off. And I guess, is that the goal? I don't know. Is that a sign that you're doing something right? If everyone's pissed off, is that kind of how you approach it?
I've heard that many times. I don't know if I'm comfortable with that. I mean, so I have a friend whose mother lived in the Villages in Florida, and she was caught up in this belief that voter fraud had actually happened. And so my friend compiled this dossier of Reuters stories that was like, no, here's the numbers for this. Here's the numbers for this. Here's the numbers for this. And finally, over a long period of time, and I want to say weeks, because she decided, you know, there's some news sources she won't trust anymore. And this is not a commercial for Reuters, I promise. But over the course of several weeks was finally convinced, but it was her daughter telling her this stuff with a list of things and facts in front of her. And it took a long time. I mean, I think when people have embraced propaganda, or things are not, then things that are not true, and they just profoundly believe them, it's really hard to deprogram them. And that's probably going to be something we're going to have to spend years doing in the US.
What do you make of the, and this has been a trope for as long as I've been around, probably 50 plus years, the liberal media bias trope? Is there a self-conscious aspect to that where going into a story, you feel like, well, you know, Republicans, conservatives, Trump voters, et cetera, are going to be irritated by this because they're going to see it as a liberal media bias. So therefore, we have to kind of soften the story, or we have to present some sort of, you know, alternative aspect to this. Like, well, what's the other side doing, too, that's kind of balances this out? Does that trope factor into anything? Because I think the outside sense is that there's a self-conscious reaction to it. Like, okay, this was beaten over our heads for 50 years. And so therefore, we have to kind of sculpt the news around it and react to it in a sense, not directly, but in a tacit way. Is that something that factors into decision making on publishing a story or not?
You know, that's a good, I mean, I don't, I, from my own experience, no. And I, you know, grew up in small towns and went to high school in a pretty conservative small town. And so I don't think I've carried, you know, I don't think I've carried the, you must be a liberal chip on my shoulder. Yeah. I don't know. I just, it's the, that is sort of a slur against somebody is kind of funny, you know, at this point. But has it happened in the media? Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that there's a natural, I mean, we saw the sort of spate of stories about like the far right and Proud Boy fashion and all of those things. We're like, oh, Lord, help us. You know, there's sort of this almost like, because this may get to the fact that newsrooms still have a lot to do on diversification. You get a lot of white reporters being like, oh, they're kind of like us. They grew up in this kind of town and with this kind of, you know, I don't know, upper middle class, but yet they've gone way off the scale politically. Like, how fascinating. Let's figure out what's going on there. You know, you may see some of that. I haven't personally. Yeah. Yeah. I don't think in you know, in my work experience had editor stories or things ever felt like somebody, you know, said, you know, to overcome the fact that you may have, people may say we have a liberal bias, we need to present things this way.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
Well, I mean, except for just that you do, yeah, you do need to talk to, you do need to, and maybe this is where the both sides frustration comes in, but you do need to, you know, talk to people from across the spectrum. And yeah, yeah. If they're saying things that are demonstrably not true, then you can say they're demonstrably not true.
Well, let's say, for example, in the coming 10 months, let's say starting this month and taking us all the way through midsummer toward the midterms on the horizon, and there is one great economic story after another coming down. All of the various economic indicators are showing vast improvement in the job scenario. The Dow continues to climb. GDP is looking strong. You know, write down the whole list of things, which I'm sure you're abundantly familiar with. And it's all great news for the Biden record. Do all those things get reported on? And this is not necessarily specific to you at Reuters, but generally speaking, will those things get reported on, or will they be watered down with, well, we also have to present some good news from the Republican side too? Or
no, I don't think so. No, I mean, there's no, it's, you know, it's sort of like jobs data should be jobs data. And we can go into a whole conspiracy about those revisions, which is maybe not a conspiracy, who knows, but no, but I think there's, no, I mean, economic data is economic data. It's, yeah. It's what's going to happen no matter what. And again, because the Republican Party is so divided, the one thing that they can agree on is that they want to do everything they can to make this presidency unsuccessful, you know, and to get him out of office and to make sure that, you know, he looks, you know, they're that's the one thing they're really united on. And so you can expect as those numbers come out, you know, again, some of this like, yes, but the costs of XYZ are high. You know, there's going to be a lot of noise coming of, again, these Washington think tanks and things that are funded by conservatives that do publish economic research. And, you know, you'll hear a yes, but you will. And and it won't, you know, and it's. I mean, a lot of these are pretty mainstream organizations that journalists in this city use and quote all the time to talk about, you know, how the economy is doing. So,
wow. Absolutely. Well, you know what? Look, Heather, I'm so glad you came on the show, and I thank you for being a good sport. This obviously for me is a real challenge to analyze, having come from the print press, having come from, I mean, I've been publishing on the internet since the 90s. And so
sure. Where did you work before? Tell me.
Oh, I wrote for Salon. I go all the way back with the Huffington Post to when it was, when it first launched in 2005. I wrote a weekly local music column for the Reading Eagle newspaper in Reading, Pennsylvania. That was my first professional print job. And then prior to that, I was the editor-in-chief of my campus newspaper in college and so on. So I have, you know, one foot in that arena. And so it's a real challenge for me to, you know, as someone who respects and supports the institution of the press, to also see and criticize some of its downsides. And there are downsides here. And I also recognize the dangers that we're in right now politically as far as democracy under threat and so on. And I'm trying to figure out a way, and obviously this is kind of the source of our conversation, trying to figure out a way how the word can get spread while still adhering to journalistic integrity, while not necessarily abandoning objectivity. How you draw that fine line between raising concern among readers versus remaining objective. And that's extraordinarily challenging. And I give you all the credit in the world for continuing to persevere and to crank out some great reporting at Reuters. And it's such an impossible task. I don't know how you do it.
Well, thank you. And I'm going to, let me send you some of these great investigations that we've done recently. I think, I think that just sort of moving beyond this is dangerous to, like, here's how this specifically is dangerous to these people right now. This is what's happening is one of the ways that you do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I mean, and these stories should ring a lot of alarm bells, I think.
Yeah.
People that are reading them.
Absolutely. And that's the thing that everyone should bear in mind, too. Just because you don't see a headline pop up in your feed on Twitter doesn't mean it's not getting reported. There's stuff going on all the time that never gets shared on Twitter, gets shared on Facebook. And I encourage everybody, if you see a great news story, share that thing. Like it, share it, retweet it, whatever you have to do to get the word out, because that's going to encourage more of that kind of reporting, whether it's the climate crisis or the latest Trump atrocity or good news from Joe Biden, and all points in between. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, I got a link in the description under this episode to follow you, Heather Timmons, on Twitter. And of course, you can follow Reuters on Twitter as well, at Reuters. Link in the description for that, too. Thank you again, Heather, for coming on the show today. I really, really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.